It's one of the most interesting local news wars in the United States right now. The Baltimore Sun newspaper versus the upstart Baltimore Banner website. Who is going to prevail? Will there be lessons from Baltimore for other cities and regions? Those are a couple of the questions for this week's Reliable Sources podcast. So let's cue the music. I'm Brian Stelter, and this weekly podcast is our chance to go more in-depth with media leaders and newsmakers, talking about how the news gets made. A recent headline in the New York Times says it all about Baltimore. It says, "Is Baltimore big enough for the two of them?" The story says, quote, "The internet's pretty much killed local news wars, but the Baltimore Banner, a nonprofit startup, is trying to change that by taking on the Baltimore Sun." Some listeners might know I grew up in Maryland. I went to school right near Baltimore. I've always been a reader and a fan of the Baltimore Sun. But like a lot of people, I've seen it decline over the years. It has been shrinking for years and years, partly due to corporate ownership. And it turns out that's one of the reasons why David Zurawiec left the Sun last summer. He was a media critic for the Sun and a writer for the paper for 32 years. But he decided to retire from the paper without exactly saying why last summer. And now he's a CNN media analyst and a professor at Goucher College. So when I've been reading about the Baltimore Banner, watching the launch this summer, I wondered what Zurawiec's impressions were. And I wanted to see if he would open up about why he left the Sun and what his impressions are of what's changed at that paper over the years. It turns out he has a lot to say about that, as well as the state of the news media more broadly. So let's get to the conversation. David, welcome to the Reliable Sources podcast.
Thanks for having me. And this is not a Sunday morning. And Brian, you don't have to tell me, Zurawiec, keep it short. So.
That's right. We'll have more time now, lots more time to talk in this format. And there's a lot to talk about. I was thinking about you in the past few weeks because of this incredible news rivalry that's happening in your backyard in Baltimore. So it's been almost a month since the Baltimore Banner launched, taking on the Sun. Have you been reading? How's it doing so far?
I'm happy to see the Baltimore Banner here. I mean, obviously, competition, forever, competition has always been a good thing in the media. I've never seen where competition is a bad thing in the media. So in just a general sense, I think the Banner is going to be very good for Baltimore. Now, beyond that, the Banner has skimmed some of the serious cream off the off the top of the Sun in terms of talent, and so that's going to be strong. They're already breaking stories and doing stories, so I think it's going to be good. Understand, the Banner doesn't have as many reporters, as big a staff yet as the Sun, but with Alden owning the Sun, I don't know what the future of that staff's going to be. Someday it may be smaller than what the Banner has. And the Banner has very good people. And there's an energy there, Brian. But so far, maybe the best thing I can say about it, or the thing that's most attractive to me about it, is that there's an energy on that site, on that platform. And you can feel it.
Yeah, I feel that same energy. When I was at home in Maryland recently, you step off the train, one of the first billboards you see is for the Baltimore Banner. Like, they are making a bold statement in the city as they launch. And how's the Sun handling it? What's your impression of how the Sun is? Is the Sun just ignoring the new competition?
That's my sense. I mean, that's my sense. The Sun wants to ignore it and say, we're the paper, that's been here. We have the largest staff in Maryland. But there's a deeper issue here, Brian, with that in connection with the Sun. I was at the Sun for 32 years. I love the Sun in a lot of ways. I was a true believer in the mission of that newspaper, and we did some great work, I thought. If Alden didn't own the Baltimore Sun, I would probably still be working there. I would not have left the Sun. I have personal reasons for leaving the Sun. There's always more reasons than one when somebody makes a career decision like that. But here's the thing that really cinched it for me. When I thought back, I had some time now to think about that departure and look at it from different prisms and different angles. And here's what it came down to. This is the question I couldn't answer. If in my writings as a media critic, I'm going to use the standard that media, that journalism should serve democracy, and my God, at the moment we're in this country's history, boy, was it needed now, as they used to say about That's Entertainment. Boy, do we need it now. We need that. Alden, what it does with newspapers that it buys and then hollows out is a threat to democracy. They cannot cover the community the way they used to. You've talked about this so much and done such great reporting with the media team at CNN on this, about how you start to lose state house reporters and then you don't cover city hall as much and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If I'm saying that Fox News is bad because it doesn't serve democracy, what do I say if I'm taking a check from a company, a hedge fund, that is doing that systematically to regional and local papers? I'm a hypocrite. I'm a hypocrite if I'm doing that. Now, I'm not saying every reporter should necessarily feel that way, but as a media critic, I can't criticize people for not serving democracy when me and just about everybody who knows anything about media in this country knows that company is not serving democracy with the way it runs its newspapers. Mm-hmm. So that was the bottom line. And also, Brian, as you know, and you're doing this too, teaching at NYU, I teach over at Goucher, and I've taught there for 20 years. The one thing students, college students, at least in my experience, won't tolerate is hypocrisy. They'll put up with a lot, you know, with a professor. But if you're a hypocrite, they're going to call you out in a second. And they would, I thought, how could I face those? How could I teach them media ethics, go in and teach a course in media ethics, or go in and teach a course in media criticism and say, oh, no, you know, you have to serve democracy, when some of the smarter kids are going, oh, yeah, are you doing that with Alden's or how's that working out? So for me, that was the deciding factor ultimately. And also while I was there, I mean, in the last year, I started to get pushback from management as Alden started to ascend. You know, they got a seat or two on the board of Tribune, right, and then they made their move. Well, once they got those seats on the board, it was pretty much a done deal, unless Stuart Bainum could get it, you know, and then that fell through. But as they came under the influence, let's say, more and more of Alden, I started to get pushback out of nowhere that I know, on being critical, and I was writing opinion at the time, an opinion page, about Donald Trump. And this was in the run-up to the 2020 election. And I'm like, what? You know, that had never happened in 31 or 30 years. So, you know, to me, I don't trust an Alden-owned company.
Now, hold up. I don't think I've heard you share this before. You're saying that when you were at the Sun, you started to feel some sort of pressure about what you were writing?
I was told straight out one day, hey, stop being so snarky about Trump. We need to stop being so snarky about Trump. This was in the opinion pages. And I was like, really? Wow. And I have to say something, Brian. I didn't leave right at that, you know, at that time. You don't walk away after 31 years on a dime. But I was discouraged. I was discouraged. And I started questioning myself in a way that you can't, and be an effective journalist or especially effective media critic, saying, do I believe these things I'm saying if my actions don't match them? And look, you know what? I'll tell you, everything since has proved that to me that I had to make that decision and it was the right decision. When I saw, for example, last week and Cassidy Hutchinson speaking to the 1-6 committee, you know, I thought, how would I have felt if I was sitting here not, you know, and just going along, oh, yeah, Alden's a fine company, blah, blah, blah. And this woman who's 25 years old has the courage to stand up and say what was going on at the White House with Trump. So it's a moment in democracy where we all have to do that. If I believe in democracy and newspapers' role in that, then I couldn't work there anymore. It's that simple. And again, there's really good people there. There's people I have friends who maybe they won't talk to me again because of being critical of the Sun this way. But that's the truth of it, you know? Now, God bless America that I'm writing for CNN.com these days. That makes me very happy, too, that I was able to do that.
But as I listen to you, I'm getting the impression that you held back on sharing this criticism at first, you know, of the Sun, that you didn't want to go and burn the bridge on the way out.
Brian, that's absolutely true. I didn't want to be the face of Sun bashing because it was going through a period of a lot of serious bashing because a lot of the reporters and editors wanted to go work for Bainum, you know, and I think a mindset can set in for folks over there that why didn't Bainum offer me a job? I mean, why didn't the Banner offer me a job or, you know, and I didn't want to be part of that. And honestly, you know, I can think of somebody as I'm talking to you who's a friend of mine. And I think that guy's probably who's still there, is going to probably be really mad at me and not talk to me. But, you know, we're at a point in media and American politics and history where I can't feel justified or righteous in letting any affection I have for folks at the Sun affect what I say about my feelings. And I'm just talking about my feelings and how I perceived it. And so I have to do it. I can't be a hypocrite. You know, I couldn't write for you know, I my credibility mattered to me over 32 years of battles with companies and people threatening to, you know, sue and everything else. I'm not going to give it up at the end of my career. I thought I'm just not going to finish my journey as a journalist working for these guys and letting them define me this way. I've got a lot more journalism in me, and I'm going to do it somewhere where it's good and it matters and I can serve democracy. And so far, that's been absolutely the case at CNN.com. So God bless us.
What were the other pain points or pressure points relating to Alden? Was there anything else where you could sense this takeover by this hedge fund happening?
Yeah, the IT and HR, things you don't think of much as a journalist. You know, you want to be you think about, you know, editorial freedom and things like that. Those kinds of resources, by the time I left, were almost non-existent. You would try to call HR for things. You wouldn't get calls back. IT, you know, there was one, person I worked with a long time. I called her up for something just before I left. I remember something in terms of medical insurance or something. And she gave me all the information and gave me things. And I said, well, can I call you back at this number? And she said, no, this is my last day. I'm out of here. And there was a feeling of that. And I had the sense that she was, you know, either bought out or you know, she'd still be there if Alden hadn't been there too. So look,
it's a good point. It's on the back end. Sometimes it's those what they would call efficiencies.
Yes. Yeah, Brian, you're so right. And it's so important when you're trying to do your job to have that kind of support, to know that you can get an answer. You know, the woman who was leaving, by the way, once I remember I woke up like on Christmas Eve and thought, did I fill out my dental insurance as of December 31st? And I sent her an email and she answered me immediately, you know, went into the records and found it. That's gone. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. That stuff's gone. Mm.
But it sounds like the core issue for you was you were going to be a hypocrite to stay there and try to be calling out, you know, other aspects of media ownership and all that if you were under Alden's thumb. That makes sense. I get it.
It's totally, Brian, it's totally true. And the people in media who would be criticizing, they're not stupid. They're smart people, too. And they could see that contradiction. So, you know, a paycheck is, you know, it's nice and all of that. And it's not easy walking away from something after that time. But for me, it was impossible to feel I was to feel the energy to be righteous in this job.
Well, so now that you're on the outside of the Sun and you're continuing to see and hear about Alden's impacts, where do you see the paper going? You mentioned, you know, some folks have left. Maybe others are looking to leave. Maybe at some point the Banner will have a bigger staff than the Sun. Is there any counter argument? Is there any counterpoint where you see it not getting so bad?
Well, people say to me, and this is interesting because you hear people say this at the Sun. They're like, you know, it's not, you know, Alden's not that bad. You know, all they care about is money. They don't care about the politics, which wasn't my experience apparently. But you know, if you stop and think about that and say, well, and they think that's a good thing. I mean, maybe Alden's reputation is such that people say, well, the only thing you can say about bad is that they only care about money. They'll do anything to make money. That's not so bad. That's a good thing in America these days anyway. You know, that's hallowed these days sort of business. But, and that's true of a lot of platforms, a lot of media platforms, maybe surely the majority of them. But you know what's lost in that? And this is what troubles me. I hear young journalists saying this to me, is that the notion of the public service aspect of American journalism. You know, when they gave out those broadcast licenses after 1934, after the Communications Act, broadcasters had to broadcast in the public interest. And that, of course, being Washington, it wasn't carefully defined, and everybody in corporate media figured out a way to get around it. But they used to do, you know, Sunday morning public affairs programs like CNN still does today. We've lost that sense, I think, so much of public service. And I try to, as a professor, I try to push it to young journalists. But I know when they get out in the newsroom on an internship or something, they are not hearing that. They are not hearing about, hey, we have a public service. And that's always been the model. That was the model for a media in this country, media in America, once upon a time, at least in the 30s when that act was written, that you had to be, okay, you are a business. And the idea was, we're not going to try to regulate newspapers the way we regulate broadcasting. But you have a public service commitment. In fact, you know, the Pulitzers give out one of the biggest prizes is for public service. We still pay lip service in a way to public service. But in the newsrooms, I think at papers like the ones owned by Alden, that gets harder and harder to find. That's where you can cut. Hey, we'll cut that big project that we were going to do that was going to expose this or that. Too expensive, too many people on it. We can barely cover the events around the city we need to cover. So that's part of the problem, I think, losing that sense of public service, public interest. And I don't see that coming back at a place like the Sun. I hope it does, and maybe it will, but there's a lot of, you know, Alden's a tough, tough company. They're not saying, hey, oh, you did a nice public service piece. They're saying, hit your bottom line or this is my reading of them, hit these numbers or we make changes.
Hmm. Well, let's compare and contrast with the Banner. So you mentioned Stuart Bainum, who is funding the Banner. He said to the New York Times he'll give it at least 4 to 5 years, but at some point he expects a profit. You know, the implication being he's not going to stay doing this and he's not going to lose money on this forever, but he's willing to lose money on it for 4 or 5 years. Is that realistic? Do you think he could actually create a sustainable Baltimore news organization in the next 4 to 5 years?
Well, you know, I think the biggest danger that the Banner might have mentally, internally, is thinking this money is there, even though he says 4 or 5 years, that it's there forever.
Right.
And it's because they're doing good stuff, it's going to be fine. No,
right.
They have to know it. And I do have to say, I talked to a reporter from the Banner 2 days ago, as a matter of fact. And he's a very good reporter. And I was interested that out of his mouth came the words is, hey, yeah, I'm excited, but we got to make this thing work. We got to make it work financially. So they're getting the message. They're not lackadaisical in thinking this money is going to be there forever. Personally, and I've written this, I am not, there's a feeling among some, and there's a lot of it in media, that rich guys will save us. You know, I don't think rich guys are going to save us. I think rich guys are rich guys because they know how to make money. Now, God bless Bainum for wanting to fund 4 years of this. But you're right. He's not going to go on forever with this if it doesn't figure out a way to at least be sustaining. I don't think he's looking to make a profit. I think he just doesn't want to lose a lot of money. Is it possible? Well, you know, I see they partnered with the with WYPR, local NPR station here. And they have some foundation money and some philanthropy. I think they really need to look hard, and they are, obviously, if they partnered with them, at the public broadcasting model and the way local stations have won enough support in them in the community that young people come out of college, they maybe live in an apartment or get their first home, and they don't have much money, but they contribute to public radio. You know, whatever it is, they contribute when the fundraising starts. You have to, I think, get to that model, get to that if you're going to go longer. Right now, look at public radio and how it does it. Also, look at some of the models like The Guardian and ProPublica especially. You have to do great work. You have to do work nobody else has. You know, when I saw the coverage of Charlottesville by ProPublica and Frontline, that marriage where they went out and did those great reporting before really anybody else about the right-wing white supremacist threat in this country, and the fact that none of the Virginia authorities or even the federal authorities were prosecuting any of those people carrying tiki torches and saying, you will not replace us. And they got some prosecutions after their reporting. My wife wrote the checks before I even got, she grabbed the checkbook and wrote checks to ProPublica and to support Frontline. That's the way you get support for people. So they have to do great work, but yeah, they also have to do all the right things that public broadcasting does to bring people into the fold, young people, as they come out of, as they go into the workplace or whatever.
Right. That's a great point. You have to create a habit of consuming news and paying for news and supporting news. I think one question I have is whether Baltimore is a big enough a metropolitan area to have enough of those readers. And that's the same question that, you know, exists in a lot of these locations where startups are trying to rebuild the local news ecosystem. I hope it can. I mean, I absolutely hope it can.
I know. And I know you have a great affection for Baltimore. And look, I'm going to live here. I live here. I live in the city, not in the county. You know, I'm a lifer here. And I hope it does, too. I don't know if it's big enough for that. And, you know, there's another problem here. As you were saying that, it occurred to me, and this has always been true, it's also the reason we had good journalism here. When I came here from Dallas in 1989 to work for The Sun as the TV critic, I quickly realized my work wasn't being judged against another local paper. My work was being judged against the Washington Post, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the New York Times and USA Today, because we're on this belt on the East Coast geographically. And that's right, what my editors were reading.
Right.
So we have a higher standard of journalism, I think, in Baltimore than we would in a lot of cities this size, except we also have a lot more options for people here to get their news. And so maybe they say they're not going to, when you say, will there be a large enough audience? There's a lot of other options in this area for people to give their money to and support.
Right.
So, you know, maybe they're giving it to WETA because they listen to classical music all day on WETA. And they don't listen on the Baltimore station. That makes it tough for the Baltimore station to compete. You know, so it's both a blessing. We have the audience has higher expectations, but if they don't get it from either of them, they'll give their money. They'll spend their money elsewhere. I think that's a possibility.
Definitely. Lots more to talk about. Quick break here on the Reliable Sources podcast and more with David Zurawiec in just a moment.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support. Your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back here on the Reliable Sources podcast. I'm Brian Stelter, continuing the conversation with David Zurawiec, the former media critic for the Baltimore Sun, now a CNN media analyst. David, what are you working on these days? We've been talking about the past and talking about the Baltimore news wars, but what's keeping you busy these days?
CNN.com, Brian, has, I don't have to tell you this, has very high standards, has excellent editors. And they demand a lot of work before you get into print in terms of reporting and all of that. So I've been working really, especially the last few weeks, hard for them with these hearings. It's great to be on a platform with that kind of power and reach during these hearings and during this moment of challenge to democracy. Right now, I'm working on a piece. I'm not going to give it away because somebody might hear this and jump me on this and get it on before I get it on CNN.com. But I'm working on a piece about media use by members of the committee. Let's just leave it there.
Okay. That's a good preview. So your impression of the hearings so far, clearly you are in the camp that believes these are important. These are not just show trials, as the Fox stars like to say.
Oh, listen, I did a preview piece and I said, look, usually we can use history as instructive. If you don't learn from history, you make the same mistakes. So I said, okay, everybody's looking at Army McCarthy hearings and the Watergate hearings. Those are the touchstones of TV hearings in the history of American television. But the world has changed so much in terms of media that you can't measure what's going on in this media in terms of that. Nobody's going to, one of the people I called up said there isn't an audience of 40 million people sitting out there with relatively open minds. We're polarized now. That's not going to change. Some people aren't even going to watch. Some people don't want to hear. But I think there's a great media story here this summer in how the committee and with James Goldstone, from former ABC president, how they adapted the TV hearing formula to today's media environment. I think it's absolutely brilliant now. And I think given the new landscape, the numbers they're getting are even more impressive than some of us have been writing. I mean, 13 million for that, for the Cassidy Hutchinson hearing last week. Just think about that. 13 million viewers. That's in real time, right?
Yeah. Right. That's 13. Just the average of every average minute. I was impressed by the data that Fox Sports executives shared, that said overall these hearings have reached at least 56 million people at some point during the hearings.
Yes.
So it's cueing up a big audience.
Yes. I saw that in the newsletter. I went, wow, that is the news right there, that audience. But you think about an afternoon television in July on mainly broadcast and cable. Oh, they're both. Wait a minute. Broadcast TV is supposed to be dead. It was dead 20 years ago. It was a dinosaur. Oh, wait. you know, and cable's old now too. You got to call cable old. You can't say cable's a new media. Hey, 13 million people. That's a huge audience. You know, I'm one of, maybe because I'm like, I'm of another generation, but I still say, you know, people act like media. Oh, something new comes along and the old media is dead. No, radio is still hugely popular and it should have been dead in 1952 when American homes started bringing television.
With TV, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
So I still think, not broadcast TV, I think it shifted definitely to cable, but those hearings on cable TV on a Tuesday afternoon doing those kinds of numbers in July, unbelievable. They're doing a great job. And I think it's really fascinating for me right now, the challenge is trying to tease out what they're doing. I mean, a lot of us are writing about this, but I'm really zeroed in on it to try to figure out what is it they did to adapt it, and what can future hearings do? What can the political apparatus in this country do? Because I think these hearings may have had an impact on Trump that nothing else has had. You know this better than me or as well as me. Trump is a creature of television. If he doesn't see himself on that screen, he doesn't exist. I mean, I think that's his mentality. Being on the screen, and he's from the generation that wants to see himself on television. He likes social media, he's fine, but come on, let's not get serious. Truth, you saw how effective Truth Social was last week when he was trying to counter what the hearings were doing to him. It was like, who cares what he's saying on Truth Social? This is what matters, what's on my screen. Being on screen for Trump is like blood for a vampire. He needs it to live, and he's not getting it this summer. I think that's another interesting story there. But what it is that the committee, and I think to some extent, a big extent, Lynn Cheney, what they're doing is really effective to cut through. You know how hard it is to cut through the madness of social media. I mean, all of the polarization, all of the people who just spend their life sitting on there saying crazy, mean stuff to people, you know, to get your message through the media ecosystem we are now swimming or perhaps drowning in is a magnificent feat. And I honestly, I did not think this committee was going to be this effective because it is such a big challenge. But they're doing pretty well so far.
But does any of it matter if there's a completely separate parallel media structure in place to ignore it or to make fun of it?
Brian, I couldn't agree more with you. You know, honest to God, that's the question. You've posed that on Sunday morning so well, I think last Sunday. That's the question. I mean, are we so far gone? I mean, the next question after that, or the extension of that question, is are we so far gone that we can't survive as a democracy because people don't, we can't figure out a way to do what happened in town halls in this right. new media environment. And we haven't figured right. that out yet.
I think the question is like, is there any good faith left to be able to have a common reality? Or is it all bad faith acting? Like I was reading this great New York Times story today about the disinformation agency, that weird thing the Department of Homeland Security
yes.
was trying to do, that they got terminated. And the Times framed it in a really interesting way. They say disinformation's become another untouchable problem in Washington because no one can agree on what disinformation is and because there is disinformation about disinformation. And so there's a quote in the story that says, we're unable to have a calm discussion about this problem, and there's a weird circular looping around effect. Quote, the problem itself is helping make us unable to talk about the problem.
Well, that's after
that. And that
brilliant.
Was like, I was like, that is, there it is. That's the problem right there.
We
can't even the problems are in, or, you know, they don't make it possible for us to even have conversations about solutions.
It is. And, you know, you were talking about some of the ways my focus has changed. I think one of the things that at least since 2016 that's been demanded is that you can't in a way, well, you can cover part of media, you know, you could review shows and that sort of thing, television shows, but you can't really function as a media critic, I think, is as you and I maybe define that term, without being pretty, being steeped, I would say, S-T-E-E-P-E-D, if I'm spelling that right, steeped,
yeah,
in political science and government and understanding democracy. You know, I'm looking at my bookcase and I'm looking at the book I'm reading now is Four Threats, the Recurring Crises of American Democracy by Robert Lieberman and Suzanne Mettler. And Lieberman, I quoted in the last piece I did on the hearings for CNN.com. And so I knew when this book came out because it caused a stir and I read excerpts, but now reading that and reading how democracies die and the fascism this time and on tyranny, all people you've had on your Sunday morning show, you know, you can't write about media without this context of what's happening in democracy. I mean, if you don't understand this, how can you talk about Tucker Carlson going and genuflecting before Viktor Orban in Hungary and holding him up as a model of strength and Joe Biden as a model of weakness and saying what a clean, orderly nation he has opposed to the chaos created in America?
Well, you can. I mean, you certainly can perform a version of media criticism. I just don't think it's very honest. It would be incomplete to be talking about the media and not be talking about what this parallel universe is doing in the U.S. and abroad.
Brian, that's absolutely true. That's what I mean about it. It is inauthentic in a way to try to say I'm doing media criticism if you're not doing that. Remember, I guess it was the run-up to 2020, but it was probably 2019, when Trump had those social media folks at the White House. The people who are on social media brought them in and he sort of had a nice day and then they had something out. And it just had to be before COVID out in the road, outside on the lawn. And it was all these people from the fringes who would pump his message through social media. I mean, you and I know there's an army out there it's like an army of automatons that'll just attack and won't even listen to, well, maybe they're bots. No, but I mean, you know, I'm thinking of the last time I was on your show and said something negative about Twitter and the takeover of Twitter and how the army that assaulted me. I mean, it's out there, and
the pro Elon Musk Twitter trolls. They are pretty intense.
Absolutely. That was it. You know, I said we can't let guys like Elon Musk control the channels of communication in his country. And you know, I think the wave of assault went on for like 4 or 5 days. I would even like click on and go, "Wow, they're still coming." You know, so but that's out there. That's out there, and they're gonna, you know, look at what happened. How they tried to go after Cassidy Hutchinson after her testimony, after, you know, she should be a role model to young people about how to serve democracy, about how to function as an adult in a democracy, that the sacrifice it sometimes takes. That wasn't what you heard on a lot of social media as they tried to discredit her. So that's the world we live in.
But it's notable you log in and they're still yelling and they think they're being heard and they're not.
Yes.
And they're not, they're yelling at nothing. They're yelling at no one. They're not being heard.
That's exactly.
That's a great point. Where do you find hope and optimism, if anywhere, right now?
Well, you know, I'd like to say, you know, actually, straight up, you know, Cassidy Hutchinson gave me hope. You know, I mean, I deal with college students and I really love them. I really do. And I really worry about, you know, I try to get people internships and move them into the workforce and jobs that they're hoping to get and stuff. And, you know, I know some of them, you know, they'll come back and say, "Oh, Zurich, I got an internship at this and such a company." And I go, "Oh, my God, they're going to just teach them such bad stuff there, you know, but, you know, it's a paycheck. And I'm sure their moms and dads are happy that they're getting some education and it'll be something on their resume. But how do I handle talking to them? What do I tell them to not dampen their enthusiasm? I think it's too simplistic to say future generation young people are going to save us, because there are a lot of forces that grab those young people and co-opt them into the system of, don't worry about it, just go do this story, it'll get us ratings, it'll get us clicks, you know, so what? Forget what you learned in college from Zerwick in media ethics. You know, but then you see, you know, you see someone like Hutchinson come through that and work at that level of the White House and still know right from wrong. And you think maybe there is hope with young people. I also think this, Brian, I think there are a lot of really bright, really seasoned, and some very young, not seasoned, but some very young, really, really smart, aggressive people covering media now. When I was in my 30s and covering media, we didn't understand how much the networks owned us and played us. We really didn't. I didn't. I look back now sometimes and I cringe, and I thought I was really knowledgeable and hard-nosed and blah, blah, blah. But the people at CBS News, for example, could really play us, and they really played me for a while, for a long time. So that's, but we have a better generation of reporters, you know, and coming up, not the ones right out of college. I think the ones who have been in it a few years and who have seen this, I think your generation is what I'm talking about. I think that's our hope. That's our hope. You know, when I was doing this, we didn't have a reliable sources newsletter. And the Sunday morning shows, Brian, they weren't as tough as yours. They were kind of nice. It was kind of an in-house club of guys, you know, old time, you know, same guys talking about it every week. Now there's a real body of criticism out there. I don't think we're reaching that the people who don't want to watch the hearings or don't want to hear anything. That is a political problem in this country. And I don't know how, a cultural problem, educational problem. I don't know how the heck we solve that. I mean, some of it's as simple, you know, I can say to people my age, they should teach civics in the schools again. Well, they should teach civics in the school. That's not going to solve it. That's not, we're so far past that. Right. We don't know where, but I really think there's an energy from this generation, a younger generation of critics, that is going to help educate people about the media. You know, they say teaching media literacy is the answer. Yes, I'm all for it. I've taught courses in media literacy, and I still teach courses in media literacy. But it's not, it's one thing to study it in a classroom and you think it's abstract. When they read a piece of journalism, or they see someone on your show who has battled it that week in a sort of existential career-ending situation, it makes a difference, and it tells people there are high stakes in this game, and you have to figure out whose side are you on. Are you on the side of democracy, or are you on the side of these other people who don't seem to care anything about democracy, just think they'll use media to their own ends. They'll grind the property up until they can wring every last dollar out of it, and then they'll dump it. The hell with what happens to the civic life of the community that property was in. That, you know, if we educate people, it's one of the reasons, you know, at first I just wanted to sort of leave the Sun. And somebody said this, they said, just go away, don't deal with it for 6 months and the world will come to you in a way. And I needed some time to think it through. And everything in the last 6 months has told me, no, you need to be at least as good as this 25-year-old woman and talk about what you've seen and what you think is a threat, what your threat to democracy is. You need to talk about it. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm totally wrong about it. But I feel I need to say that. And I'm so, you know, you say, what are you optimistic about? I'm so optimistic and blessed that I'm able to write at a site like CNN.com. that cares about journalism as I imagined it to be and always wanted it to be, and also understands the role, the massive role a property like CNN plays at this moment in American history in terms of democracy.
Well, you've brought it around full circle for us, going back around to Alden and Baltimore and why it's important to be outspoken. It certainly is. And like you said, maybe you're wrong, but we've got to have the conversation.
That's right.
And have it out in the open. David, thank you so much. Thank you for your righteous energy, and thanks for bringing it to us.
Thank you. Brian, thanks for having me. I love working with your team. It's fantastic.
And that's a wrap for this week's Reliable Sources podcast. We will see you on television this Sunday and every Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time on CNN. And as always, thank you for tuning in.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.